TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Robert Fisk on the Armenian Holocaust. The ongoing controversy about the Armenian genocide. When on June 2, 2016, the German parliament overwhelmingly adopted a resolution declaring the killings of Armenians by Ottoman Turks in 1915 a genocide, the Turkish government angrily denounced the vote as null and void, and Prime Minister Erdogan called his ambassador in Germany back for consultations. Fear spread among German political leaders that Erdogan might retaliate and unleash tens of thousands of refugees that Turkey currently hosts. Robert Fisk is the award-winning Middle East correspondent of the London Independent. He has reported from the Middle East since 1976, speaks Arabic, and lives in Beirut, Lebanon. Fisk wrote on June 2, 2016 in The Independent that Germany now joined France and Russia and at least 18 other nations who accept the Armenian genocide as a fact of history, along with Pope Francis, with the U.S. remaining the sole major exception. Fisk was the only journalist who pointed out that the refugees and migrants who Europe tries to keep out come in many cases from the very towns and deserts in which the Turks committed their acts of horror against the Armenians 101 years ago. Fisk goes on to write that the skulls and bones of Armenians still lie in the sands south of the Turkish border, which ISIS now controls. And when al-Nusra captured parts of Deir ez-Zor, they blew up the Armenian cathedral of this Syrian city, took the bones of genocide victims from the vaults, and scattered them in the streets. End quote. In the context of these events, here is Robert Fisk, recorded in San Francisco, after the 85th anniversary of the Armenian Holocaust, as he chooses to define it. He had just been attacked in the media for using that word.
3 days ago, my paper received this email from Mustafa Gulek of Ankara. It's to me, of course. Dear sir, I had no idea what bad feelings Mr. Fisk harbored until I read in your paper today the one-sided, ignorant rantings that one usually only hears from badly educated, ill-informed, and bloodthirsty third-generation U.S. Armenians. So obviously, ladies and gentlemen, we have a lot in common tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, 8 years ago, on a grey, cold, damp day in the first week of March of 1992, I walked the side of the hill of Hurghada, a place of black volcanic stones high above what had once been the valley of the Habur River in northern Syria. An old Armenian woman, Surbohi Parpasyan, she's dead now, had sent me here from her village 12 miles away. She thought, she said, she thought she remembered finding the bones of Armenians below the hill of Hurghada 77 years earlier. She was looking for the bones of her sisters and father. So I had gone to Hurghada, found the hill, realized that the river had changed course over the decades, and I wandered down the hillside in the steady rain. It had poured rain so much over the previous weekend that small streams had opened fissures in the hillside. It was almost at the bottom that we saw what we suspected all along lay in this volcanic earth, a mass of skulls and bones embedded in a wall of earth on the side of a crack in the hill. I used my car keys to scrape away the mud, and the bones began to fall out of the earth into my own hands. rib cages, femurs, an entire skeleton, then another and a third, so closely packed that the bones had become tangled with each other. There were sets of teeth, fibula, eye sockets, tightly squeezed together as they had been on the day they had died in terror in 1915, roped together to die in their thousands. Each skull became clammy as I held it in my hand, and its first contact with the air since the Armenian genocide, they began to become soft and disintegrate. The teeth were clean, undamaged, the teeth of young people, children, teenagers. My Armenian companion and his little boy held one of the skulls. "It is finished," he said. We later handed these bones to the Armenian church in Deir ez-Zor for proper burial. Yes, the evidence of the 20th century's first Holocaust, and yes, I call it a Holocaust, not an Armenian claim, lies under those desert sands of northern Syria. Countless thousands of those skeletons, of course, lie beneath Hurghada and beneath the fields and riverbanks of Turkey. Further north, up the Habor River, I came across caves with bones inside. Armenians there remember that this is where their ancestors were driven below ground and asphyxiated with the smoke of bonfires. They were, of course, the world's first primitive gas chambers. But my Armenian friend, I think, was wrong. It is not finished. For I believe, after 25 years watching the tragedy of the modern-day Middle East, that history cannot be buried or denied beneath the earth. As long as a people cannot receive acknowledgement of their torment, it is never finished. Until the history books are accepted and honoured as true, the story has not ended. The Holocaust, which began the 20th century, happens to have taken place in the lands that I now cover as a correspondent. Indeed, with my frequent visits to the Balkans, I sometimes think I must be the Ottoman correspondent of The Independent, rather than the Middle East. So, the Armenians met their fate in the lands I now regularly visit and on which I report. So how come, I found myself thinking, how come, not long after I arrived in the Middle East, how come that the first act of genocide was so often referred to as a claim, when the second great act of genocide, the Jewish Holocaust, was accepted as a terrible fact of history? Of course, we all know that Hitler, before planning the slaughter of Europe's Jews, asked if anyone still remembered the Armenians. But is there any excuse for us to cast doubt on what happened to the Armenians? Is this any reason for the Armenians to be virtually excluded, as they virtually were, from Britain's Holocaust Day memorial in January? What was the BBC, and I have the letter here, what was the BBC producer Daniel Britton Catlin doing, writing to an Armenian group in France last 16th January? BBC coverage, he wrote, and here's the letter, is likely to include reference to, albeit briefly, the Armenian genocide. I liked the albeit briefly bit. So briefly perhaps, that the deniers and revisionists of the Armenian Holocaust might not notice the BBC's puny supply of courage in making any reference to 1.5 million murdered Armenians at all. Of course, I know, and we all know in this room, of the Turkish lobby groups which perpetuate the myth that there was no Armenian genocide, that your ancestors died in a civil war in which Turks died in even greater numbers. We all know about the economic sanctions levied on France after President Chirac signed the document acknowledging the Armenian genocide. We know how Britain, my country, fears to lose its own economic contracts in Turkey. And we know surely, as indeed we do, of the extraordinary, in other circumstances, I would say bizarre way in which President Clinton persuaded your lawmakers not to acknowledge the Armenian Holocaust because he said it might put American lives and interests at risk. What was he thinking? That an American genocide might follow the Armenian genocide? What was this great danger? What would have happened, for example, If today's Germany had threatened economic penalties, if any acknowledgement was made of the Jewish Holocaust, would Mr. Clinton have made the same incredible statement? Of course not. But let's turn to my own profession, journalism. How is it that we free people, we reporters, we who are supposed to be the first witnesses of history, play a double standard over the Armenian and Jewish Holocausts? How can we lend credence to one group of deniers while rightly denouncing the other group as right-wing fanatics? Let me take, for example, a New York Times report of the 26th of March, 1988, about those few Armenians, 70,000 in all, who survive in present-day Turkey. Here now is a key paragraph from that report by the New York Times reporter Stephen Kinzer. Please do not chuckle at various points. Listen to these words. Relations between Turks and Armenians were good during much of the Ottoman period, but they were deeply scarred by massacres of Armenians by pro-Ottoman forces in eastern Anatolia, carried out in the spring of 1915. Details of what happened there are still hotly debated. I told you not to do that. But it is clear that vast numbers of Armenians were killed or left to die during forced marches in a burst of what is now called ethnic cleansing. Now I have, ladies and gentlemen, a serious problem with that paragraph. First of all, the figure of 1.5 million Armenians, or even 1 million Armenians, the all-important statistic that puts you in the genocide bracket, indeed marks the Armenians as victims of the first Holocaust, has totally disappeared from the record. It's not in that paragraph. We are left with what Mr. Kinzer calls vast numbers of killed, which keeps the New York Times out of harm's way with the Turks. Then genocide is reduced, you'll notice, to what Mr. Kinzer calls ethnic cleansing, a phrase familiar to us from the Serb war against the Muslims of Bosnia and against the Albanians of Kosovo, but on an infinitely less terrible scale than the massacres of 1915. So 1.5 million has been deleted, and we've lowered the potency of what actually happened. And note the reference to pro-Ottoman forces, not even Ottoman forces, and certainly not Turks. Note that the word Turks is not used in reference to the killers at all. Then we are told that the issue is hotly debated. How very fair of the New York Times to remind us so tamely that a campaign exists to deny the truth of the Armenian Holocaust. It's a lie every bit as evil, in my view, as those who wickedly claim that the Jewish Holocaust never happened. What am I as a journalist to make of this? Did I imagine all those bones tumbling into my hands in northern Syria? Were they not real? And what am I to make of this headline? This headline from the same series on another of Mr. Kinzer's articles. Armenia never forgets, maybe it should. You missed that at the time. Now let me speak frankly. I think the New York Times reporter didn't want to offend the present Turkish government. He didn't want his feature article to be called controversial. He didn't want to stir things up. So he softened the truth, and the Turkish government must have been delighted. Now let's apply a simple test. Let's turn to that later and more numerically terrible Holocaust, that of the Jews of Europe. Would Mr. Kinzer have written in the same way about that mass slaughter? Would he have told us that German-Jewish relations were merely deeply scarred by the Nazi slaughter? Would he have suggested, even for a moment, that the details were hotly debated? No, he would not. But Mr. Kinzer did raise doubts about the Armenian Holocaust. He called it hotly debated. I have written frequently of the Armenian slaughter, and I did so again at the beginning of last year. I had been deeply moved by a meeting I had with a 101-year-old blind Armenian in the Armenian Old People's Home in Beirut. He was called Hatun, and he remembered how in the Syrian desert in 1915, his mother pleaded with Turks not to rape her 18-year-old daughter, Hatun's sister. As she begged them not to take my sister, they beat her to death, he told me. I remember her dying, shouting Hartun, 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 over and over. When she was dead, they took my sister away on a horse. I never saw her again. Then, after years of bitterness and longing for revenge, what Hartun called his Christian belief overcame him, and he decided to abandon the notion of revenge. When the Turkish earthquake killed so many people, he told me, I prayed for the poor Turkish people. In my article in which I wrote of Hartun, I used a capital H in my reference to both the Armenian and Jewish Holocausts. I believe that capital H should be attached to all Holocausts. Little could I have guessed how quickly the dead would rise from their graves. For when my article appeared in my paper, a paper which has never failed to dig into human wickedness visited upon every race and creed, my reference to the Jewish Holocaust remained with a capital H, but the Armenian Holocaust had been downgraded to a little h. Tell me, Robert, my Armenian friend asked me, tell me, didn't the Turks kill enough of us? Of course, I at once investigated what had happened. There are no conspiracies on the independent sub-editor's desk. Just a no-nonsense rule that our articles follow what is called a house style. Through common usage, as it's called, I love that word, common usage, the Jewish Holocaust takes a capital H, other Holocausts don't. No one is quite sure why, though the practice has been followed in books and articles worldwide. The Jewish Holocaust should be capitalized, I said, not because its victims were European Jews or that of any other race, but because its victims were human beings. It was, after all, the Independent's editorial policy, my paper's policy, that the world must fight against all atrocities, that we should never accept the idea that one group of victims had special status over the other. When Armenians in Israel speak of their people's suffering, they use the Hebrew word Shoah, which means Holocaust. Common usage, I said, can't decide morality. And so the Independent then ran an article by a Turkish Cypriot academic denouncing my own report on the Armenians, but on top of his article, we used the words Armenian Holocaust with a capital H, and so we always have since. The Turks did not complain. The world did not end. There was an Armenian Holocaust. Those skulls I found in the desert were real. But you should not believe that the debate over the Armenian genocide does not take place inside Turkey. It does. I have several good Turkish friends who tell me privately that they believe there was a genocide, that Ottoman Turkey was responsible, and the statistics are right. One of these Turks is a senior government civil servant in Ankara. In the newspaper Milliyet, the journalist Yavuz Baydar was quoted as saying that, I was always convinced of the necessity to show courage and to take to task Talat and company for their misdeeds. These men are our Pol Pots, Beria's and Stalin's, and the sooner we call their crimes to account, the better our chances of redeeming ourselves from this scourge of being accused of genocide. Dr. Taner Akçam, author of several Armenian studies, said, and I quote, the constant refrain of we Turks are not guilty, and the parallel blaming of the Armenians, who are the victims, very much hurts the cause of Turkey. Unless we distance ourselves from the perpetrators of this crime, which was a genocide, soykırım in Turkish, we will never be able to relieve ourselves of this terrible burden. The destruction of the Armenians is a historical fact organized by the government of the day. Ask for forgiveness from the Armenian people and make a commitment that in Turkey, political dissent and disagreement should no longer be treated as an offense. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to ask you an important question. It's not a proposal. I'm a newspaper reporter, and nothing I'm saying to you tonight I haven't written in my paper or spoken of before. But it's a question I'd like to put to you. In Israel, they honor the non-Jewish men and women who tried or succeeded in saving the lives of the Jewish victims of the Jewish Holocaust. They include people of every nation. They honor what they call the righteous Gentile. And I've always thought this a fine idea. And I've wondered from time to time, I'm just asking this question, why you haven't thought of doing the same. I don't just mean thanking the foreigners, the German missionaries, the Swiss, the Dutch, the English and American teachers, the French and British and American navies, the saviours of the people of Musa Dagh. No, I'm thinking of those examples. I've heard about them from ageing survivors, and I've come across them in contemporary documents. I'm thinking of those people who tried to help your ancestors and who were Turks. I'm talking about the good Turks, the very occasional Ottoman official who was appalled at the atrocities committed against the Armenian people, the Turkish or Kurdish villager whose courage stood out when his own people were turning so brutally against your ancestors. Many of you will remember from your school books, I think, the story of Jalal Pasha, I think it was, the Wali of Aleppo, who said he was a governor, not an executioner, and thus saved thousands of Armenian lives. It was he who said that it is the natural right of a human being to live. The Armenians will defend themselves. In September 1915, Rahmi Bey of Smyrna was reported as saying he would not expel the Armenians. Also Haj Adil of Adrianople. Then there is Ismail Kemal Bey, an Albanian and governor who was dismissed because he refused the genocide orders of the Turkish Committee of Union and Progress. Then there are the little men. Zakhar Beberian was 12 when the Turkish army and gendarmerie came to Marash in 1915. Before he died in Beirut, he told me how he saw babies being dropped on the roadway by Turkish gendarmes, how if they survived, their brains would be beaten on the road, how his parents died of cholera. I should have died, he added, but a Turk gave me food to survive. Indeed, in almost every interview I conducted at that time, Armenian survivors would recall few but individual Turks who, driven by their Muslim religion or common humanity, disobeyed the fascistic orders of the rulers in Constantinople and sheltered Armenians in their homes. You can find their ghosts even in the great Bryce Report on the Armenian Genocide, published by the British Foreign Office in 1916, a volume unlikely to have recorded the good deeds of Turks or Kurds or Arabs, had they not been true. An Armenian report included in a State Department dispatch of the 17th of September 1915, for example, quotes a report from Arab deputies from Baghdad and Syria who recall that the railway to Aleppo discharges into the mountains vast numbers of Armenians who are abandoned there without bread or water. In the towns and villages, the Arabs try to bring them some relief. A statement by the Reverend William Shedd of the Presbyterian Mission during the Urmia massacres of January 1915, after describing the vile treatment of civilians at the hands of Turkish troops and militias who participated in the worst of the slaughter, records that there were many villagers who showed only kindness. The Persian governor made it possible by his cooperation for the American missionaries to do what they did. The Kurds responded to appeals for mercy, and in some cases returned captive girls unsolicited and did other humane service. A few individual Turkish officers and a number of their soldiers took strong measures to keep order. One such officer saved the city from loot when riot had already begun. There are other examples in the Bryce records and elsewhere of such humane behaviour by men who clearly disobeyed the orders of their brutal masters. So terrible was the year 1915 in the Armenian lands under Turkish control and in the deserts of northern Syria, and so wicked were the Turkish authorities of the time, that I think it is necessary to remember that Muslims, including brave Turks, sometimes risked their lives for your doomed ancestors. And so I ask again why the descendants of those Armenians don't acknowledge in some form that courage. Armenians demand that the Turks acknowledge their Holocaust. The Turkish authorities still call it a myth. But how would they react to an Armenian démarche to remember the Turks who showed bravery and honour during that time of atrocities? Those Turks may be painfully few in number, but you would be showing modern-day Turkey that you acknowledge the humanity of some of their former citizens. How would the Turks react to such a gesture? By refusing to honour their own brave Turks? Or would they remember the courage of those Turks and by the same token accept the fact of the Armenian genocide? It's only a question I'm asking. Corporal Omer would be remembered, and the Turk who gave 12-year-old Zakhar Beberyan food. So would Jalal Pasha of Aleppo. And it might be a very small step in the story of the Syrian desert, of those skulls which prompted my Armenian friend to say, "It is finished," when, in my view, for the historical record, the story has still not ended. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for the invitation to address you tonight and for your patience in listening to me.
That was the journalist and Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, Robert Fisk. He spoke before the Armenian National Committee in San Francisco in March 2001. Fisk continues to tell that story and also to encourage Armenians, and maybe others as well, to honor and remember those who refused orders to kill and speak out against genocide in too many other places where it lies dormant and continues to define our present. Thanks to Jeffrey Blankford for recording Robert Fisk in 2001. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. And the mailing address is Post Office Box 44, Calpella, with a C, like cat, Calpella, California, 95418. That's tuc@tucradio.org or P.O. Box 44, Calpella, California, 95418. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and passing out. The precious moments to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.